After a seven-year effort to come up with a new global trade pact, talks at the World Trade Organization collapsed earlier this week. Some experts say the end of these negotiations could mean an end to decades of continuous expansion of global free trade deals. With me now to fill in the details of what happened and what it could mean is Simon Cox, economics correspondent for The Economist magazine. Welcome to our show.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Who has been involved in these negotiations?
Well, the WTO has over 150 members, so it's an extraordinary broad range of countries. This last summit that ended in failure had a smaller number of about 30-odd trade ministers. And you know, many of the key fights were really between seven trading powers.
Are they the key players?
Yes. The United States is clearly one of them. What's become very interesting in this round is the prominence of countries such as Brazil and India and latterly China.
So what finally ended the talks? Was there a single issue that they just couldn't get past?
There was. It was really India and China's reluctance to agree to a tariff deal that wouldn't allow them to raise tariffs in the event of a surge of imports. There was a huge amount of controversy about what counted as a surge of imports. So it really founded on the nervousness of India and China about exposing its farmers to foreign competition.
Well, there are tariffs all over the world. How is this any different than any of the other tariffs for industrial goods and farm products?
They would have been much higher. The idea was that you would agree to a tariff ceiling, and then if things worked out differently to how you expected and you saw a flood of imports ruining your farmers, then you would be allowed to raise tariffs very high, much higher than they've been for decades. Now, I, to be honest, don't think those fears were particularly well-founded. I don't think the Indian farmer had too much to fear from a successful Doha round. Nonetheless, in India, it's a tremendously controversial issue, and the trade negotiator knows he has to answer to some extremely vociferous critics back home. So they decided that they couldn't do a deal.
And was the U.S. the only participant that refused to accept that clause?
It was. The European Union didn't care too much either way. Unusually, the European Union's usually at the center of most trade controversies. Here it was really on the sidelines. So it was really about pitting America's farm exporters that sell quite a lot of soybeans, for example, in China, pitting their interests against the nervousness and insecurities of those two big emerging nations.
Have the United States presidential candidates spoken out about the collapse of the talks, as far as you know?
I haven't seen anything, but generally speaking, both of them seem slightly more in favor of these large multilateral rounds than they are the bilateral negotiations that have been causing so much controversy, such as with Colombia. So I think it's probably in both of their interests to say something bland about how this is a shame, how it would have been nice to have a boost to the world economy at this time, but not to commit to doing anything soon about it.
So this is not just a Bush administration position. This is a position that people in this country might have taken no matter what their political party?
The domestic American politics of it are interesting. This idea of a multilateral liberal trade is a legacy of FDR, really. It's Cordell Hull and Roosevelt. It can trace its origins back to that period. So there is a sort of democratic history, but clearly the Democratic Party at the moment is much more nervous about trade, and most surveys of American people suggest that their views of trade have soured as well. So I don't know how much support this trade round can expect to get from a possible Democratic president.
Well, a fair number of Democrats were upset by the Clinton administration's approach to trade agreements. So this has been a debate within that party for a while, but not resolved. Do you think that China and India would have remained so adamant if the United States enjoyed better standing in the world arena?
Yes, I don't think it was a referendum on America's unpopularity. It was much more about their own sort of inward-looking concerns. This trade round was a strange mix. On the one hand, both these countries, China and India, were more assertive politically than they have been in the past. They really took center stage. But on the other hand, their objections were really based in deep economic insecurity, a sort of lack of confidence in the ability of their own farmers to benefit from trade. Trade is seen as something that can only be bad for India's farmers. And, you know, I question whether that's true.
And it's interesting because India and China are among the fastest growing economies in the world.
Yeah.
Do you think that they perhaps because of that, they might have taken a harder line than they would have when the talks first began in 2001?
Well, they know that their markets and access to their markets is now of great value. That's a bargaining chip that they won't want to cash in too cheaply. So they may calculate that unless, you know, America offers them something much more juicy on limiting its farm subsidies, then they won't allow America better access to their markets. It's a bargaining chip you can't cash in twice. So that may explain part of their foot dragging.
Was there no way to arrive at a compromise?
I mean, in some ways, it's remarkable they got as far as they did. I was much more pessimistic at the beginning of this marathon and session of negotiations than I was halfway through. I think that's partly a tribute to Pascal Lamy, the director general of the WTO, who pushed people very hard. But I think, you know, after a couple of days and the dust has settled a bit, you have to wonder if India ever really wanted this round. And, you know, clearly it likes to believe it's a responsible citizen in the multilateral trading regime and wouldn't want to be seen to gratuitously kill a trade round. But it didn't seem too keen on making a deal, to be honest.
Well, India and China may have been the roadblocks, but there are any number of other countries that were very happy to see this whole thing fall apart. One of the headlines I noticed was, former diplomat says failed world WTO talks a godsend for the region, and that was from the Jamaica Observer.
Right.
Was this large industrial nation versus developing nation kind of an issue?
Oh, it wasn't nearly that simple. The biggest loser is countries like Brazil. Brazil has, you know, a pretty impressive agribusiness sector, but it's still a developing country.
Although its economy is booming at the moment.
Yes, it is. And some people say that, you know, because the price of their commodities is anyway reasonably good, it took some of the urgency out of the issue for them. Nonetheless, they're clearly a loser. Jamaica is an interesting example. There are a number of countries in the Caribbean and in Africa, mostly former colonies of Europe, who enjoy already privileged access to European markets. Now, if Europe opened its markets to a wider range of poor countries, to, you know, Bangladesh and to Ecuador, then they would actually lose out. So I can see why some Caribbean ministers may have seen the silver lining in this collapse.
My guest is Simon Cox, economics correspondent for The Economist magazine. We're talking about the collapse of the World Trade Organization talks just the other day. Well, let's get back to Brazil for a moment, because China and India are important markets for Brazilian imports, aren't they?
Yes.
And was Brazil, who was Brazil siding with in this?
Well, Brazil took a very interesting position. It expressed great solidarity with India in the fight against American farm subsidies. But on other issues, its interests clearly diverged from those of India, and in particular on this question of protecting farmers. So, you know, Brazil would have been as interested in selling its products to India and China as America is. So they would have been, you know, somewhat unhappy with India's stance on that. But because of diplomatic niceties and solidarity, they haven't had too many harsh words for India.
So they were willing to make a deal with the United States while China and India weren't, but they weren't to come out, they weren't willing to come out and say that explicitly.
That's right.
Were the talks going well up until this issue reared its ugly head?
Well, I mean, in the 7-year history of the talks, they've almost never gone well. They've always inched along. It's just that, you know, through Lamy's sort of orchestration of things, there were some bright moments towards the end of last week when people thought that a deal might actually be possible. So there's a certain amount of progress that I think people are loath to see unravel now. But to be honest, this round has always been pursued somewhat half-heartedly. It's a successful trade round really pits a country's exporters and their ambitions against its industries that fear foreign competition. So the debate takes place as much within a country as it does between countries. The problem with this round is people's exporters weren't really interested enough in the big trading powers such as Europe. There wasn't too much for them to win that they hadn't already accomplished in previous trade rounds. That unbalanced things. It meant that it pretty quickly became a question of, just appeasing everybody's farmers.
Well, is it significant that the talks broke down over food issues rather than manufactured goods issues?
I think it's somewhat significant, and China's sort of late entry into the controversy is particularly pertinent. You may have seen news reports that, since the food price crisis, China has decided that it really needs, a strong agricultural sector. And so, rather than concluding that because of high food prices it needs to open up to cheap imports, it's concluded that it actually needs to move closer to self-sufficiency. So it seems to foresee a future for itself where, its farmers would prosper behind quite high trade barriers and they would feed the nation.
But that sounds almost like a retrenchment back to the kind of thinking that Chairman Mao had. In recent years, what's driven China's economy has been the manufacturing sector.
Yes, it would be an extraordinary turnaround if true, and we'll have to see if it really takes hold. But it does. It did seem to play a part in the minds of its negotiators at the last. I mean, up until now, China has benefited a great deal from the WTO and from the access to manufacturing markets that the WTO provides. But here they played a somewhat less constructive role, you might say.
But as you suggested earlier, this is being driven by worldwide food shortages?
Well, this feeling that, we can't rely on foreigners to provide food for us, it's a little bit illogical because, of course, if prices are high, then you want, cheap food from wherever you can get it. You don't want to start, raising tariffs that would increase the price of food domestically. But I think the feeling is they need to maintain, a thriving farm sector at home. And if that means protecting them with tariffs, then so be it. That's the story as far as I can tell what's going on in the minds of Chinese negotiators at the last.
Historically, have there been different standards for global food trade versus manufactured goods trade?
Yes. I mean, massively so. Until the last trade round, the Uruguay round, which was completed in 1994, agriculture wasn't discussed at all. The rich countries, basically America and Europe and Japan, just liberalized their manufacturing sectors quite aggressively and successfully. So the idea was that this round, the Doha round, would finally start to constrain some of the very peculiar farm policies that rich countries still pursue, the very large subsidies they lavish on quite small numbers of people, and the quite high tariffs they impose.
I'm talking with Simon Cox, economics correspondent for The Economist. Did you see the article in today's Times about Brazil? In which they talk about why Brazil's economy is booming while larger economies are struggling with recession and housing crises?
I haven't seen that particular article, but I assume it's largely because commodity prices are doing very well.
So its economy is less vulnerable than some?
Well, it benefited from precisely the things that are causing such problems for other people. It sells the things that are now so expensive for everyone else to buy. Also, I mean, you have to give Brazil its due. It's come out of a long period of macroeconomic precariousness and now looks to be extremely well run. Its central bankers seem very disciplined and responsible. So
it's been called a sleeping giant for so many years.
Correct.
It's finally everybody's surprised that it's finally awakened.
I guess that's true, yes. But it's always had this underlying strength in things like soybeans, and suddenly those have become much more valuable on world markets, and it's reaping the benefit of that.
And now also fuels coming out of sugar, which it has in great quantity.
Yes, I mean, that's obviously a bit more controversial, but is also playing to its strengths. I mean, in a logical world, we would all be buying a lot of our agricultural products from countries like Brazil, and we wouldn't have, quite such vast farm sectors in, countries like France or, even to some extent, the United States. Brazil should be prospering from agriculture. It's where its natural comparative advantages lie.
Although there are arguments for eating locally, which is a whole other discussion.
Right.
What were the goals of the original talks when they first began in 2001?
It was largely to bring some sanity to farm trade. It's the most distorted of all kinds of trade for longstanding historical reasons. And the thought was that developing countries such as Brazil might benefit if countries like America stopped subsidizing their farms quite so heavily and countries like Europe opened up their agricultural markets a little bit to cheaper producers elsewhere. That was the ultimate aim. And America and Europe were supposed to gain from slightly easier access to the burgeoning markets of the Indias, the Chinas of this world.
But we have a weird irony here. The United States subsidizes its farmers, and at the same time, that was what killed all of these negotiations. The United States didn't want to agree to India and China being able to subsidize its farmers.
Well, it was India wanting to raise tariffs that would help its farmers in a slightly different way. That's right.
Well, aren't tariffs a form of subsidization?
They are. I mean, it's technically different in that it makes products more expensive rather than cheaper, but certainly it helps the same kinds of people. I mean, there's huge hypocrisy on both sides. So, India and China will point fingers at America for throwing money at its farmers, and America will say, how could you possibly raise tariffs to protect the same kinds of industries? I've been somewhat critical of India in this interview. I mean, it's worth underlining that America shouldn't really be in the business. I mean, America's the most sophisticated, richest economy in the world. It shouldn't really allow the WTO to unravel because it wants to sell more farm products to a country like India, which has, over 200 million farmers. There is a sort of basic absurdity to the setup. Nonetheless, within the sort of narrow tactics of the negotiations, I think India didn't play a particularly constructive role.
Although this is a weird worldwide reaction, and we have very little time, but a spokesman for the local farmers' association on Japan's northern island of Hokkaido told the press that since the WTO talks broke down, we're breathing a sigh of relief for now. Ever since the liberalization talks began in 2001, we felt like we were being slowly choked to death. And an Irish minister said that the talks' failure was a huge relief. Were those the official positions of the Japanese and Irish negotiators, or are they the feelings of local farmers?
No, that pretty accurately reflects the positions of the negotiators. Agriculture is a tremendously sensitive issue for many countries. There's no particular logical reason why that should be so. There's no particular logical reason why America should want to spend $7 billion on an industry that only employs about a million people. But nonetheless, that's how the politics have congealed, and it's very difficult to undo them now.
And other countries, Burkina Faso's trade minister said, we can hardly control our anger. We're most disappointed that the rich countries are afraid to trade with us on an equal footing. Well, we have run out of time, but I'm assuming that this is not the end, and sometime or other we will come to some resolution. Hope to talk to you about it then. Simon Cox, economics correspondent for The Economist magazine. On tomorrow's show, catcher-turned-sportscaster Tim McCarver with stories about some of the baseball stars he's known over the years, from Sandy Koufax to A-Rod. We'll hear about Kate Field, who was a fiercely independent celebrity journalist in the 19th century. George Pelicanos on his new crime novel, The Turnaround. And Please Explain is all about how our muscles work. The Leonard LoPage Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Stephanie Hughes, Lauren Bonner, Catherine Ident, Molly Lister, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard LoPate, your host. Thanks for listening.